cardiac failure and VV ECMO can be incompatible.
Welcome back to Pete's Grit. I'm Zach Hodges, a pediatric ICU fellow from UT Southwestern in Dallas.
And I'm Alice Shanklin, a critical care fellow at Children's National in Washington, D.C. Zach, what are we talking about today?
So today we're starting a series that overviews a fantastic outline of the entire VV ECMO course for patients in the PICU and the NICU. From the decision to cannulate, to optimizing your flows, titrating your rest event settings, and even more complex protocols like the decision to extubate and how to mobilize your patients while they're still in the pump.
And Zach, I feel so lucky that you have recruited not one, but two experts for this series. We've got Dr. Jenna Miller, who's a pediatric intensivist and an expert on the PICU side, and Dr. John Daniel, who is a neonatologist and really speaks to care of the infants on the NICU side.
Yes. Dr. Jenna Miller, she's an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Missouri Kansas City School of Medicine. She completed her medical school and residency in Kansas City prior to moving to Texas Children's for a critical care fellowship. She is the director of the Pediatric ECMO Program and the Pediatric Critical Care Medicine Fellowship Program Director at Children's Mercy Kansas City.
And Dr. John Daniel is an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Missouri Kansas City School of Medicine. He completed his pediatric residency at the University of South Carolina, his neonatology fellowship at the University of Kentucky, and he is now a practicing neonatal cardiac intensivist. He's the director of the Neonatal ECMO Program, and we are so grateful to have him speak to the care of neonates.
Yes, so excited for this series. Let's go ahead and jump in right to part one.
Welcome back to Pete's Grit. We are so excited to be here with Dr. Jenna Miller and Dr. John Daniel to talk about this very important topic, VV ECMO. So to get us started, John, Jenna, please tell us a little bit about yourself and feel free to include something you enjoy outside of medicine.
Thanks, Zach and Alice, for having us. We're really excited to talk about our love of ECMO and how we manage our patients here at Children's Mercy in Kansas City. I trained in residency and medical school in Kansas City. Then I went to Texas Children's, and then I came back to Kansas City because I really love the city and the hospital and my family's here. Outside of medicine, I really enjoyed going to travel everywhere. So internationally, domestically, I really enjoy seeing other parts of the country, parts of the world, how people live, how people go about their day-to-day lives. And I think when I come back to the States and back to Kansas City, that helps me be really a better person and a better physician because I have seen a wider variety of how people, you know, experience life. So I really enjoy that. Plus the beach is, you know, real nice. So that is fun for me.
Oh, definitely. That sounds like the ultimate inspirational hobby.
Dr. Daniel or John, will you just tell us about yourself?
So I've been in my current position here for about 5.5 years. I took over as ECMO director a little over 2 years ago. It's been a fun ride to learn and kind of help our program grow. You know, outside of the hospital, when there's time, I think we all need to have time outside of the hospital. So it's very important. I'm a big fan of travel. I love international travel, and COVID was a big challenge during that time span when everybody was locked down. But my wife and I enjoy traveling across Europe, and we're both very much into medieval history. Oh. So we go to a lot of castle ruins, and we kind of prep for our trips by reading a bunch so that we know that, you know, this king or that king built this castle. And it's good to take the mind off medicine.
So fun. There's some travel themes here in our intro questions. Really intrigued by this. Maybe it's a wellness activity I need to get more involved in.
How did you become interested in ECMO specifically?
I was thinking about this question, and I thought it was a really great question. I thought back, and I thought, well, the first sign was that I wasn't intimidated by it, I think, early in my training. And that kind of evolved slowly over my fellowship and early faculty life. And I had a great ECMO mentor here when I was early faculty, and I enjoyed watching the program evolve where we were extubating patients and using new equipment and new technology. And then I say it was probably cemented by a patient who I'll talk a little bit about later in my kind of middle faculty year so far, where we had two fairly back-to-back patients that have to date really been our longest run patients at 120 and 190 days.
Wow.
And so just really watching the investment, the thought process, and the mental gymnastics really that go into maintaining a patient on circuit for that long and thinking about how to move them towards decannulation, I think really cemented my interest in ECMO and in that population.
And John, how about you? How did you become involved in ECMO and why do you continue to do it today?
Yeah, so I was very fortunate in fellowship to go to a program that was very ECMO heavy. And I got exposure to it very early in my fellowship as a first year. And I remember standing there as a first year fellow, watching this really, really sick baby undergo this procedure to put these big cannulas in their neck and then magically seem to like stabilize and get better. And I just thought that was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. You know, I was also fortunate in that the NICU and the PICU were literally right next door to each other, and you could walk from one side to the other very easily. So I got to learn from a lot of neonatologists. I got to learn from a lot of peds critical care docs. And I ended up just thinking ECMO was the coolest thing we do. And so that's kind of how I got interested in it. And then during fellowship, I got interested in some QI and some research related to ECMO. And I was just very fortunate that my primary mentor in fellowship, he was the ECMO director where I trained and continues to still be a great mentor to this day. We find ourselves calling each other quite frequently to be like, hey, I have this patient. Tell me what you would do. So it's been nice to have those connections. But I just thought ECMO was the neatest thing that we could do and the babies would get better. And I just didn't think there's anything cooler. That's kind of how I ended up in it. So when I came on as faculty, one of the reasons that, you know, I joined the group that I did was they do a lot of ECMO. They have, the hospital has invested a lot of effort and time and money into really creating a fabulous team that I was just really happy to join. And then about 2 years ago, I got the opportunity to become ECMO director. So I got to be Dr. Miller's partner in crime, which is always, always fun. Now, a lot of my work that I do when I'm not on service is trying to stay up on the ECMO literature as best I can. Mm-hmm. There's so much that comes out. I work in several research groups throughout the, it's called the Children's Hospital Neonatal Consortium, and they have various work groups, and I'm in one of the ECMO work group. We're 36 of the biggest NICUs in the country, and so we all pool data and look at clinical questions related to neonatal ECMO. So that's, you know, the big part of my job is keeping up on that so that I can bring that information to my colleagues and my peers.
Jenna, do you have any resources or ideas or networking strategies for trainees who may want to become more involved in this area?
I think over time I have learned these things by my own experience, but now what I advise my trainees who are interested in ECMO or any really extracorporeal support to do is most institutions will have some sort of executive committee or steering committee for that support. And so usually they will let trainees sit on those committee meetings and just observe and hear what are the issues, how do we implement strategies, how do we think into the future for this program. And I think that's really valuable for trainees. So just asking if that's available at your institution, if you're able to sit in, would be something I'd recommend. And then the two biggest ECMO meetings really are ELSO in the fall and something we call Keystone, which is in Keystone, Colorado, which is why we call it that. But both meetings I think are great for trainees, and I personally like them because they're smaller meetings. So you actually can kind of see the same people over and over again. And as you mentioned, network and kind of meet the grandfathers and the grandmothers and the current leaders of ECMO in person, which I think is really amazing. And when you think about the history of ECMO, it's really since the 1970s when Dr. Bartlett did the first run, and he's at these meetings. And so it's just very inspirational, I think, to kind of see the whole history of ECMO all in one place. And so those are kind of the two biggest meetings that I would suggest people go to, or, you know, think about taking a case report to, or anything else that their mentors might be working on.
Oh, wow. That does sound like an incredible opportunity.
John, how about you? Do you have anything you want to plug, whether it's be PICU or NICU fellows who may want to be more involved in this area?
I think how I ended up at the facility I am at now was when I was a fellow attending an ECMO conference. There's several great conferences, I think, for fellows to attend. From a networking standpoint, you're going to meet all the really big names in ECMO, a lot of the pioneers of the field. It's really cool to go talk to Dr. Bartlett, who invented ECMO. I think for a first-year fellow or any fellow who wants to get more involved, just talking to the faculty, talking to your ECMO director, talking to your fellowship director, say, hey, I'm interested in ECMO. I'd like to learn more. And then just go reach out to them, because really it's just exposure and seeing it. When I started learning as a fellow, there were, you know, as a first year fellow, I didn't really manage the ECMO kids. I just kind of stood there and watched and listened and heard what everybody was talking about. And then as I got more comfortable, they said, hey, maybe why don't you manage this kid and, you know, do things like that. It's really just being vocal about what you're interested in. And then I think that often will lead to a QI project or hopping onto a research project that a center is doing. And that gets you the opportunity to go and present at some of these great conferences. The first conference I went to was the ECMO conference in Keystone, Colorado, the Children's National Conference that's each year. I got to meet Dr. Bartlett. I met Billy Short, Pearl O'Rourke, a lot of the big names in ECMO, who when you're reading these classical papers, you're like, oh, I met you, which was really fun. So the Keystone Conference is a great conference. And then there's also the ELSO Conference every year. The ELSO Conference is great. I know Dr. Miller and I went to it in Boston and learned a ton just from everybody across the world, really. That is a great conference to see what's going on globally. Another thing I always encourage people to do is follow your ECMO nurses around, follow your ECMO specialist, follow your perfusionist. They're going to teach you more about the physical hardware of ECMO than I ever could. They're going to know the ins and outs of every little setting on that, the components of the system, how it's run, to really get a complete kind of understanding. There's the medical side, but then there's the technical side also, which is where all those specialists are so important to learn from. And they've taught me a ton. And I still learn, to this day, I still learn a ton from our ECMO specialist.
Oh, absolutely. Let's start you off with Case.
Okay.
It is a busy day in the PICU and NICU in Kansas City. You have two patients that have you concerned. Your first is a newborn girl admitted with respiratory failure. She was born at 41 weeks gestation through meconium-stained fluids. She was intubated in the delivery room and subsequently transferred to your unit the following day due to worsening hypoxemia despite high ventilator pressures, FiO2, and the initiation of inhaled nitric oxide. Your second patient is a 16-year-old male with hypoxemic respiratory failure due to pneumonia and ARDS. He was intubated 2 days ago, and despite lung protective ventilation and multiple adjunctive strategies, he has worsening hypoxemic respiratory failure. We are worried that both of them require VV ECMO. Thankfully, you are on service. Since things aren't looking great for either patient, sort of at both ends of the age spectrum, let's review. What exactly is VV ECMO?
So VV ECMO stands for veno-venous extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, and it's a lung bypass system specifically, which is going to drain blood from a vein and return the blood back to a vein. So this is different from VA, which is veno-arterial ECMO, and is a different topic that we won't go much into today. Commonly, this type of ECMO is done through a right internal jugular vein. That mode of ECMO requires the patient to have intact or at least adequate cardiac function, because we are not replacing the function of the heart in this type of ECMO. So that's really important delineator about deciding who should get this type of ECMO versus who should get VA ECMO. The circuit itself, once we connect to the pump and the circuit, is similar in that there's a pump and an oxygenator that's in series with the patient.
Nice.
So how do you really know when to initiate something like VV ECMO? Where do you draw the line in a patient who has progressive respiratory failure?
It is absolutely patient dependent and is a bit variable depending upon the cause of respiratory failure. Generally speaking, as I mentioned before, you have to have somebody who has intact cardiac function and indications of respiratory failure. So that is where you're going to start thinking about ECMO and specifically VV ECMO. The causes of respiratory failure are vast and can be infectious ARDS, ARDS secondary to other causes such as sepsis or trauma, inhalational injuries, or even idiopathic, where we don't know exactly what's going on. I'm going to refer a lot to the ECMO Red Book. This is commonly referred to as the ECMO Bible in many ECMO circles, and it is the most current up-to-date data from the ELSO registry. ELSO is something that many large centers, both adult and pediatrics, internationally contribute data to so that we have a running count of really what's going on in real time of ECMO around the world.
Oh, wow.
That book itself is really well annotated and referenced. So if you have specific questions about where something comes from in the literature, it is in the Red Book. And I'll also say, as I mentioned, that one of the indications for VV ECMO could be idiopathic. One of my current research projects is looking at ARDS caused by trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, which is commonly known as Bactrim. And so, as I mentioned in my intro, we had a patient who had a 190-day run, and she ended up actually being the first clinically diagnosed and recognized patient in our institution and was kind of the sentinel patient going forward and defining what actually this disease process looks like. So if you have a patient with unexplained ARDS on ECMO, make sure you've gotten a really thorough drug history. So to your actual question, deciding on timing of cannulation, that can be very clear where you have an acutely deteriorating patient with failure to exchange gas, progressive acidosis, And it's very obvious that, hey, we are going to need to get on pump soon, or we may have an arrest. It can also be harder to identify when that time is and a little bit more indolent, where you have a slowly declining patient over the course of hours to maybe a day and the decision is less clear. In either case, you have to determine first if the patient is indeed a candidate for extracorporeal support by considering whether you think their acute process is reversible. Historically, that was really like the only question. Is their acute process reversible? But as we've expanded indications for ECMO and decreased the contraindications, we also have to think about a lot of underlying disease processes too in our patients as they've become more and more complex. So with that, I'll say that there are fewer and fewer absolute contraindications. So when you're thinking about ECMO candidacy, think about underlying diagnoses, any absolute contraindications that can be identified, and you can refer to your handy red book to look those up. And then you think about their acute process and whether that's reversible. If you decide that they are a candidate, discussion with your friendly surgical colleagues early is helpful, so you can also ensure that it's technically feasible. There are some patients who have vascular anomalies, maybe they had previous lines, maybe they have some other reason that cannulation would be technically challenging or not feasible. And so you want to know that before you start a surgery and trying to get a patient on, especially if it's in a situation of urgency or emergency. So then after that, what is the benefit versus risk of ongoing high ventilator support for that patient and risk of ventilator-induced lung injury for that patient? I take this decision so personally, and so it can be really hard to decide when that exact moment is for those patients that are having a slow decline or maybe inability to get better on really high vent settings. But clear indications might be that you're having progressive hypoxia or hypoxemia while in a high mean airway pressure and a high FiO2. Commonly, that looks like 100% FiO2 on high APRV or oscillator settings. You may have progressive hypercarbia and acidosis with pHs around 7 or less that are concerning when you're on high ventilator settings. And eventually, these things are going to lead to hemodynamic inadequacy developing in response to the acidosis or hypoxemia that you have. Air leak, which consists of either pneumothorax, pneumomediastinum, subcutaneous emphysema, sometimes pneumopericardium, at any time with a severe respiratory failure patient is concerning, and it's really a trigger for me to cannulate when I see that. That indicates that the ventilator settings you're using, which are not adequate for your gas exchange, are already causing damage to the lungs. And so that's usually a hard stop for me to go ahead and just cannulate.
Oh, nice.
The ultimate goal for these patients is really to get on while they're hemodynamically fairly stable and absolutely to do it before you have any sort of arrest situation from acidosis and hypoxia. And as we don't have a crystal ball, we don't always know when that is. But I think just being mindful of the short-term progression of that patient, what your ventilator settings are, and how much tolerance you have for their hypoxia and hypercarbia tells you when the right time will come.
Oh, nice. So you've got these pool of patients. I really appreciate the this is my mental model for the progressive respiratory failure. Once your institutional tripwires are triggered and you've decided to call for ECMO, in this patient population, who would you need to put on VA instead of VV?
So generally, anyone with overt heart failure, and that can be right or left or both, cannot be supported with VV. The other thing is there are some contraindications that are published in the Red Book, and so you want to consider those as well. Poor prognosis from the primary disease, such as anything oncologic or congenital, severe neurologic injury or intracranial hemorrhage, anybody less than 2 kilos are things that we want to think about perhaps not putting the patient on ECMO at all. And then, as we mentioned, VV should be avoided anybody that's got obvious heart failure.
So we always were taught that VV ECMO is lung bypass. It's not heart and lung bypass. But when I think about my training thus far, almost every patient that we put on VV ECMO has some vasoactive requirement going on. Where do you draw the line?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. My answer is it depends. How helpful is that? But if you're, generally speaking, if you're on a single agent vasoactive support, it may just be that your high mean airway pressure and acidosis is causing that cardiac dysfunction, right? So we have decreased the preload a bit to the RV. We've increased the afterload on the RV with these high vent settings. And the acidosis can cause biventricular contractility issues. So it might just be that we need to get good gas exchange, bring the intrathoracic pressure down, and the heart's going to feel better. A precannulation echo can help you a little bit so that you can see how the RV and the LV is functioning. Are you volume loaded? Are you underloaded? Hopefully there's no pericardial effusions that you come across when you do that echo, but it's really important if you have time, which you don't always, but if you have time to try to grab an echo beforehand to get a sense of that. And then if you think your patient is septic, so obviously our ARDS patients may come with the bonus of having bacteremia and sepsis. And if you think your patient is septic or vasoplegic, that might be another reason that you would not be able to support the patient with just VV. And then if you have multiple inotropic agents, I think that's another clinical indicator that you may need VA. Some options. Some institutions may cannulate to VA and then convert to VV when the heart recovers. Some may cannulate VV, monitor and see as they correct the acidosis and as the gas exchange improves, does the heart improve? And if not, then their surgeon is available and ready to convert to VA. This all takes a lot of coordination between you, your ECMO team, and the surgeons about what is feasible at your institution, what people are comfortable with, and what people are willing to do. But those are some approaches.
Great. So this is fantastic.
Yes. So to move forward with our patients, let's give you a case update.
Okay.
The newborn infant with meconium aspiration and refractory hypoxemic respiratory failure has continued to worsen despite optimal medical therapy. You decide that she should be cannulated on to VV ECMO. What evidence is there that this neonate could benefit from VV ECMO?
So when you go back and look kind of at some of the literature and the history of ECMO, there are a lot of great trials that were done really to answer that exact question and say, is ECMO better than conventional therapy? And so Pearl O'Rourke was the primary author of the first study that looked comparing ECMO to conventional medical therapy in neonates. And that study she ran and published in 1987, and it showed an absolute benefit for patients who went on ECMO compared to conventional therapy. So that's really the first big piece of evidence that came out that said, hey, ECMO is beneficial to these kids. As we have advanced through time, we're obviously well past the 1980s now and have learned so much more. The concept of lung rest, I think, has really entered the critical care medicine world. Sure, we can probably, you know, limp along sometimes on high ventilator settings. You're on the oscillator. We've all walked by that room where the kid's on a Hertz of 4 and you just kind of hear the ventilator trying to wiggle out of the room because the Hertz are so low. And that's just causing more ventilator-induced lung injury. So with the data that we got from the early days of ECMO that shows, yes, it actually is beneficial. And then as we've learned more about ventilator-induced lung injury, ECMO clearly plays a role in managing these kids. The indications, I think, are changing. The patient populations that we're seeing are changing. The evolution of inhaled nitric oxide was a true miracle, to be honest, because it did cut down the patient's needs for ECMO. But there's still a subset of that population that, even with nitric, ventilator settings, surfactant, blood pressure support, their lungs are just so sick that they need ECMO.
And that's why you're here, to help those kids. Tell us about some of those common indications for VV ECMO in the NICU, and maybe some of those maybe newer ones that you've begun to notice.
So I think in the NICU, always the big question has been, does the patient have a vasopressor requirement? You know, that is one thing that always makes people pause when it comes to VV ECMO. VA ECMO is a lot easier than VV ECMO. You put a cannula in the venous side, you put a cannula in the arterial side, you can control their blood pressure, their oxygenation. So it's a lot easier. Put those cannulas in, turn your flows up, you got blood pressure, you're good to go. But I think VV is a better modality for situations where you don't have bad cardiac failure. That is an area that I think a lot of people struggle with, that I struggle with too, because I'm like, ugh, this kid's on some vasopressors. Should I do VV or should I just do VA? It's important to remember that the heart perfuses itself in diastole. And so if you have hyperoxygenated blood going through the heart from a double lumen cannula, those coronaries are going to see oxygen. And it is amazing the number of times you cannulate a kid onto VV ECMO, their coronaries and their myocardium starts to get oxygen, and your vasopressor requirement goes away. So I think each center and each individual physician has to decide what's their limit. If you're on 3 vasopressors, if you're on epinephrine, norepinephrine, vasopressin, probably not VV for you. You're probably going to want to go VA. But if you know you're on a whiff of epinephrine or a tiny little bit of dopamine or something like that, the number of times that the myocardium recovers with highly oxygenated blood is a lot. You know, I trained at a center that did a lot of VV. Rarely did we do a VA case. And so I think in the past, kind of any vasopressor requirement was, nope, we're not doing that. We're going to go VA and be safe. But I think as we've learned more about VV, kids with a degree of cardiac dysfunction can be successfully managed on VV ECMO. So generally those kids that are primary respiratory problems, meconium aspiration, severe rhinoenero, RSV, mm-hmm. ARDS, those kids are going to be your primary ones I think VV should be considered. The ones that are emerging, I think, from a lot of different centers are the congenital diaphragmatic hernias. Those patients traditionally, I think, have been managed with VA ECMO, but more and more centers are starting to use VV ECMO for it. I'm not sure about that yet. I think I'm going to have to learn a little bit more about it. I am a big fan of decompressing the right side of the heart. I also work in a cardiac setting, so maybe a little bit biased there. But I think those kids that have traditional respiratory failure, straight up respiratory failure, are your ones you're going to want to go to VV for.
Well, that's very fair. Now, after you stabilize your neonate on VV ECMO, you're called to the bedside of the 16-year-old with severe ARDS. He's developed a pneumothorax, and he has persistent hypoxemia despite high ventilator pressures and FiO2. You also decide to cannulate him onto VV ECMO. So, really taking a step back and thinking about teenagers, children with ARDS, what evidence is there that this patient could benefit from VV ECMO?
So there are not really any clinical trials or standard triggers for cannulation in this age group. There's some good data that ventilator-induced lung injury is not good for patients. And so when we look at the outcomes for these types of patients in the ELSA database, we look at the non-traumatic pediatric data, and there's a 69% survival. So if we think about the risks of staying on high ventilator settings where we know, such as in this patient, we've already developed an air leak, versus the risk of going on to ECMO, the outcomes are favorable, both in this type of patient per ELSO, and actually are more favorable than other indications in the ELSO database. So I think in this patient, the benefits outweigh the risks of getting on to ECMO support, especially in an institution that has high volume or...
expertise, per se?
Yeah, expertise taking care of VV patients.
Yes, to know that it's something that you do often and well is like gives you just a little extra comfort, right?
Absolutely.
Earlier, we talked about the common indications for neonates to require VV ECMO. What are those common indications that come to mind when you think about causes for severe respiratory failure for adolescents that require VV?
The most common things I think about are infectious or traumatic causes of ARDS or respiratory failure. On occasion, we'll have an inhalational injury, which we've had a handful of times. Increasingly, asthma is becoming a more common indication for VV ECMO. And we've done that several times with really great success. And then, as I mentioned earlier, there can be idiopathic reasons where you're not exactly sure why you're going on, but you had a healthy patient who now has severe respiratory failure and you want to give them a chance and see if you can figure it out. So that's another indication for ECMO sometimes is you're not exactly sure, but it's a bridge to a diagnosis or an attempt to find a diagnosis, which I think in certain patient populations is really important.
The classic like, oh, sure, this previously healthy teenager's adenovirus is positive, but we need to broaden it a little bit here, right? Like there's no way that they're on ECMO for that.
Absolutely. And it could be that you find a rheumatologic reason or you find, unfortunately, sometimes we do find an oncologic reason. And then, as I mentioned before, sometimes we find a drug-induced reason. So it's really, I think, valuable in a select populations to be able to do a bridge to diagnosis if there's no diagnosis going on.
And thank you for listening to this episode of Pete's Crit. Please remember that all content during this episode is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It should not be used as a replacement for medical advice. It's also worth noting that the views expressed during this episode by me, Zach, and our guests are our own and do not reflect the official position of our institutions. If you have any comments, suggestions, or feedback, you can email us at pedscritpodcast@gmail.com. If you want to help support the production of Pete's Crit, you can find us on Venmo and Patreon. We've also had some light merch made in the form of Pete's Crit laptop stickers. And if you include a mailing address with any contribution, we would be so excited to send you one. Thank you again for listening.